This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets. Just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and on this podcast, we seek out the world's best researchers, coaches, support staff, teachers, and athletes to better understand the process of long-term athlete development. Don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform and 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50. That's LTADVIP50 at the LTAD Network Hub website. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Ali Jawad. Ali is a 4-times Paralympian, a 2016 Paralympic silver medalist, 2014 world champion, and a 2-time Commonwealth Games bronze medalist at 2014 and 2018. Not content with that, he's also undertaking a PhD and is a co-founder of Accessorize. Ali, welcome to the podcast. It's awesome to be able to get you on, mate.
No, thanks for having me.
So before we dig into the Paralympic journey and, you know, the various championships and medals and records, take us back to when you were much younger. What did physical activity look like for you as a youngster, as a teenager, an adolescent? What sort of things were you dabbling in?
Yeah, so to put it into context, I was born with a disability. So I'm a double leg amputee. So I've had it all my life. So for me, like, I had to adapt a lot of my activity to kind of fit in. It's quite strange, actually quite funny, but my first love of sport was football. And I used to always play in the playground with my friends, but they obviously allowed me to use my hands as my legs, which is cool. But then I was like, how can I become a footballer if I've got no legs? And I realized that actually that's never going to happen. From a very young age, I had to always adapt to kind of fit into playing sport. But I guess my kind of dream of getting to the Paralympic Games started when I watched the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, and I watched a man called, I think a lot of people would know, Michael Johnson, win his historic 200 and 400 meter gold medals. And I think for me, it was when he was on top of the podium, he was really emotional, and I wanted that feeling. And that's when my kind of Paralympic kind of dream started, when I was about 6.
Yeah, I remember watching that race as well, actually, where both the 200 and 400, it was pretty dominant then.
Yeah.
So you obviously, you know, this spark's been lit. You think, cool, I want to get to that, like, upper echelon of performance. When did, like, powerlifting arrive on the scene in your life? And how did you come across the path of it?
Yeah, so when I was 11, I started judo. I did it for 4 years and got to a very high standard. Unfortunately, in the Paralympics, because of my impairment, it wasn't open to me. Judo is only open for visually impaired and blind athletes. So I actually had to quit judo when I was 15, thinking that my Paralympic career was over. Coming from a Lebanese background, an Arabic background, my parents were quite forceful in my academic prospects going forward. So they didn't really see sport as a way to have a career. So I focused on my GCSEs for a year, and it was actually during my GCSEs, I think it was after my maths exam, my friend forced me, like literally forced me, to go to the gym across the road from my school. And this gym was pretty run down, quite smelly, dusty, dirty. proper like Rocky Balboa style like gym, which I loved because I grew with the Rocky films. But it was actually, I started that day when I bench pressed, my first lift was 100 kilo. And then, yeah, the whole gym stopped. I actually thought I did something wrong. I thought, uh-oh, what have I done? Somebody came up to me and said, I need you to stay here. I need to go get somebody. And the owner of the gym came along and said to me, do you know what you've done? And I was like, no. He's like, well, not many men can lift 100 kilo in their first ever attempt at the gym. And he said, you look, what, 15, 16? And I was like, yeah. He's like, you have to come back. And that's what happened.
That's amazing. It's a real interesting story because I'm probably trying to get a lot of 14, 15-year-old rugby players to stop trying to bench 100 because they're nowhere near it. So how much, what do you think was the background to that? Because obviously your body weight at that point in time, were you around 56 like what you are now, or were you much lighter?
No, I was actually a little bit heavier. So I was about maybe 65, 66 at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was still an okay bench press for somebody that's never touched a weight in their life.
100%. So do you think you got a lot of carryover strength-wise from just the daily tasks you had to do as someone, as a double leg amputee, having to, you know, get around, as you said, playing football with your hands? You think that just built up this background of general strength?
Oh, massively. I think if I didn't have legs, I wouldn't be a good bench presser. I know that sounds weird, but when you're spending all your life kind of like climbing, supporting yourself, transferring just on your arms, they also become your legs. So they're doing like double the work. So I was always had that foundation of strength without really knowing about it until I got tested in a gym environment where I've actually never been in before.
Hmm. So how did that journey start to unfold? So you go in, you're messing about with your pal. People start to think, Hank, there's something going on here. This is pretty interesting. There's a guy with no legs who's benching 100 kilos in his first ever attempt. When did it start to become a more formal pathway? When did people start to say, hey, you should come along to this training camp or you should come along to this competition?
Straight away. So the owner of the gym used to be the national coach of para powerlifting. And he said, there's a competition in 2 weeks. It's the British. You've missed the deadline, but I can get you in. Also, I think you've got potential to get to the Paralympic Games. So it gave me another chance. And within 2 weeks, I competed at national level. I won the senior category, not just the junior category. And from there, obviously, Team GB were like, yep, we're nabbing him. And that's what happened. Literally, I got thrust into a world of elite sport quite quickly.
So what year are we talking? That first British champs, what year are we talking, do you reckon?
2005.
2005, right. So you're starting to, you've suddenly popped up on the radar. It's funny when you speak to people about, you know, like Miriam was fairly similar, like just randomly came across weightlifting because the coach happened to come to the school. Or like you know, what had happened if your mate had never pulled you to the gym that day, or it was a different owner who wasn't involved in the powerlifting setup. There's so many weird little fortunate events that happen. So you start to compete, you start to get noticed by Team GB. What's the progression look like through the pathway for Team GB powerlifting?
Yeah, so because of my age being so young and the sport back then was they called it an old person sport, where obviously to develop maximal strength, it takes a long time to develop. Because I was such a junior, juniors didn't do very well at the senior level. So they said, look, forget the Paralympic Games in Beijing, you're too young, because you're about 18 months away, but maybe 2012, 2016 is where we think you're going to peak. So with that in mind, we committed to training four times a week after school and college, because I still have to balance that out. And they weren't really strict on my lifestyle because they wanted me to enjoy it. They didn't want to force me into a lifestyle where it was quite strict, especially at that age, which was good. So I love training. I was still living my life out, like outside of that, still hanging out with mates and kind of doing both. The issue that I had was I was improving at a rate that nobody expected. And it got to a place where in the final qualifier for the Beijing Paralympic Games, I was actually on the verge of making that team. So I actually had to make sure that I was a lot stricter in my lifestyle because I was on the verge of making it. So on the last day of qualifying for the games, I had to break the British senior record four times to go, but I did it. And I got to go to Beijing and qualified in that top 10 men in the world that get to go.
So what weight category are we talking about at this point in time?
So back then, it was a 75 kilo class because of my add-ons. So basically, being an amputee, whatever I weighed, they added weight to my legs that I was missing. It got me into the 75 kilo class back then.
Right, interesting. How do they figure that out?
To be fair, if I explain it to you, we'll be here all day. They have taken it out now recently, but back then, yeah, if you're an amputee, you get weight added onto you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're 75 kilo class, but your body weight's actually, what did you say, 56?
No, that was at 65, 66.
Yeah. And what sort of numbers are we talking on the bench press at this point?
I had to, so I was 18, 19, and I benched, to qualify for Beijing, I benched 180 kilo at 18, 19.
180.
But I managed to get from 100 to 180 in about 18 months.
Yeah, which is, I think if most people had 8 kilos to their bench in 18 months, they'd be pretty chuffed. So one of the things that people may not realise until you dig into the world of Paralympic powerlifting is actually, pound for pound, Paralympic bench presses are far and away the best bench presses, correct?
Not even pound for pound. If you compare all the world records from the mainstream powerlifting or able body powerlifting to the para powerlifting world records in the same body weight, we absolutely annihilate you guys. Actually, to be fair, to put it into context, the able-bodied world record in my class would not even qualify for the Paralympic Games in eighth place.
Why is that? Is there a scientific reasoning, or have you got your own explanation for that? What do you think it is?
There's two reasons. One, a lot of the elite benchers in the able-bodied side have a squat and deadlift they have to focus on. So they've got three disciplines to really, you know, to actually train. And two, like, for example, being an amputee means that I've had to compensate for having no legs all my life. So even though I've got the ability to gain muscle in places that an able person probably can't, because they need legs, they've got legs, I haven't got legs. So that muscle that I would have had on my legs is on my arms, my triceps, and my chest and my shoulders. So I look bigger than what my body weight would suggest.
Mm. So at this point in time, what's the situation for you in terms of funding? Are you a fully funded athlete? Are you having to part fund yourself to get around the world for competitions? What does that look like?
No, I was lucky that at the age of 16, I got put on the World Class Performance Program. I've been a funded athlete for all my career.
Very nice. That helps remove some of the stresses. It obviously adds a bit more because then you've got to perform when people have eyes on. So you get to Beijing. Tell me about that experience.
Oh, that was... I always say to people, think about your dream and then times it by 100. It is a place where you know you've made it into this elite environment, but it's not real. Like, you're thinking, like, you wake up thinking, what am I doing here? And obviously being part of a team that had full of superstars as well, like, it was crazy, especially to do it in 18 months. So it was a dream come true. But at the same time, Beijing was also quite hard because that was when the first signs of Crohn's hit. I got kind of sick the night before I competed at the Games, which obviously had a lifelong effect after that.
So obviously you've got ambitions to go and perform to a certain level. You then have this challenge that comes out of left field in terms of Crohn's. So how did that impact your initial performance the very next day? And then what was the impact of that longer term as you were trying to compensate for having Crohn's but trying to be a high level athlete?
Yeah, so the night before I competed, I started feeling very sick. Overnight, I'd lost 3 kilo in body weight, which is quite a lot. Especially at that sort of body weight. And I was really ill, but they were going to pull me out the next day. But I said to them, like, this was my dream to compete. I was never here for a medal because I was really young. I qualified in last place. I just want to compete and we can discuss, you know, what happens in the future. So I competed. I didn't come last, which is good. Out of 12, I came ninth, which is not bad because I did qualify in last place. So for me, like, even though I was really ill, I managed to bench press 182 and a half, where my form coming into it was about 190. So I lost about 7.5 kilo overnight on the bar. But you have to remember, I didn't know what I had. I just thought I got sick. And then when we returned, it took about 9 months to diagnose me with Crohn's. But at that point, I'd lost 20 kilo in body weight. Like seeing blood in the toilet, my physical abilities completely like went. And it was literally like, you wouldn't even know that I'd competed. But yeah, like it was quite tough starting from probably worse than scratch.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, to have such a rate of progression so quickly, and then I guess almost the opposite, such a quick regression, that must have been really hard to deal with mentally. How did you, looking back, what was going on in your head? How were you trying to cope with that?
To be honest, I didn't know what was going on because I didn't know what Crohn's disease was at the time. I saw, I just took some medication and I'll be on my way. And then I remember the consultant saying to me when I got diagnosed, he said, you do understand this is, there's no cure. It's lifelong. Your life's about to change. He said, from his knowledge, no Crohn's sufferer has ever won a medal at any Olympic or Paralympic Games. It's never been done. And we don't even know if it can be. So he said, you should retire because you're always going to be at disadvantage, especially in a sport back then, which had a high, you know, level of doping violations too, because I was clean. So, you know, like putting another chronic disease on top and you're pretty much screwed.
So, you know, for those who haven't come across Crohn's, give us a bit of an idea of what's the daily, monthly kind of impact on you in terms of whether that's recovery, the fluctuations in body weight, your energy going into training sessions, your ability to get ready for the next training session. What, you know, give us a picture of, you know, compared to previously, and then this impact of Crohn's, how did that change your ability to be an athlete?
Yeah, so Crohn's is an autoimmune disease where I guess everyone's got an immune system that protects them. Mine, unfortunately, attacks me. And when it attacks me, I have loads of like nasty symptoms. I think the big ones for me are the extreme fatigue that you're under, like just like normally. And it's not just tiredness or just like training fatigue. We're talking about I can't get out of bed and move fatigue. And then you've got the extruded, like the pain that you're in. The pain is so severe that you pass out from it. And then your lack of appetite, you lose weight at a rapid rate. So I've lost a stone in a week quite easily. And obviously then you see blood in the toilet. You're very dehydrated. You look like a zombie basically. And you lose a lot of your physical qualities really quickly. Like it's crazy what Crohn's can do to you when it attacks you. And then the medication that you take for Crohn's, it's not very good for you. Like, yes, it might keep your symptoms at bay, but actually it's quite toxic and they're not good training. It's not good for training or recovery or, you know, trying to train in a way that's going to allow you to be a world-class athlete. So you have to also think about the medication that you're taking too. So I was kind of, before I felt invincible because I was, you know, 19 benching 190 thinking I'm improving rapidly. I want to bench press over 200 quite easily. And then suddenly I've been hit with, you're not going to probably bench press ever again at that sort of level.
So you obviously did, you know, you were, unlike the consultant's kind of prediction, I don't know what your reaction was, if you were like, well, I'm going to be the first, or if you were like, oh, geez, this is a big, you know, setback. You obviously found a way to manage those symptoms, to manage that, because you went on to have a huge amount of success in your career. So how did you go about managing it? Was it a case of on the days when I feel good, I go hard, on the days when I'm terrible, that's, you know, recovery day? How did you start to map it together? Because it's one thing when people have the stresses of life and work and relationships and all that kind of stuff. It's a whole nother thing when you've got this unpredictable thing that can flare up at any time in the middle of a training cycle when you're meant to be going your hardest, or the day before a competition when you're supposed to be in the peak of physical condition. How did you manage that?
Yeah, with great difficulty, I think, in the beginning. So I guess, you know, at 19, 20, getting told it can't be done, obviously ego comes in, like, oh, well, I can be the first, surely. Not knowing what was going to come at me. I think I underestimated the pain and the suffering that process was going to, what we're going to go through. Now, you have to remember, and I keep saying to people that the general Crohn's community cannot use me as the example, because I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to be a fully funded athlete with access to the most incredible practitioners that money can buy. So the monitoring strategies that we could use to monitor my, like my everyday circumstance to tackle it was amazing, right? And we got to learn, and through trial and error, we got to understand what it was doing to my body, how I reacted to training and the medication. And, you know, we were able to potentially predict what was going to happen with all the tests that were coming through. So I guess it took a lot of time to get to a stage where we could predict and understand it. But because of the trial and error that we used and the monitoring strategies were so high level, and you also had, you know, seven people working for me that were working together, we eventually did get to a place where I was consistent, but it took about 5 years to really understand it. And that's why I should never been, that's why I should never be the example to any Crohn's sufferer, because I guess I was lucky to have that support mechanism.
Mm. So obviously when we're looking at your track record as an athlete, you've got 2016 at Rio, you know, the Gold Coast, Commonwealth Games, Glasgow, that 2012 period where you'd expect maybe to see the London 2012, that's probably that period that we're talking about, isn't it? Where you're like, what the hell is going on? How do we figure this out? How do we spot the patterns and the rhythms to be able to know what we're dealing with?
Yeah, I think what it allowed us to do was to analyze whether or not what we were doing was optimal, or if we needed more help. So at the beginning, it was just like me and the coach and then maybe a doctor. And then it came to be, right, we need a nutritionist. Then we need more than one doctor to look after me, and then the consultant. Like, my team grew like way over time. And then we got the physios involved because we understood what the medication was doing to my body and my ranges. Like, eventually my team went from maybe two or three close-knit to maybe seven in order for us to understand what was going on. So it took a very long time for us to come up with a system that, I always said to try to outsmart it. And even though a lot of practitioners said to me, you can't outsmart Crohn's, if it's going to come, it's going to come. I was like, well, no, you can predict these things and make sure that you're making sure you're doing things on a daily basis and adapt to make sure that it's less likely to happen. Because you have to put yourself in a position where I had to live a certain way to be able to pull it off. And that certain way, not many people can potentially handle.
Mm. So you obviously got to the point where you were starting to figure it out, and you can get back to training and you can get back to competing. And then we start to see some pretty phenomenal performances, a gold at a European Championships, a gold at a World Championships. Talk us through when you started to come back and you started to think, okay, I'm getting a bit more momentum now. What was that like?
Oh, amazing. Because like when you're starting, well, like when I broke the world record in 2013, it justified that, you know, that I wanted to carry on. So it justified it to me that I made the right choice. It also justified what we were doing as a team. Obviously, we can get better, but the fact that we stuck at it, even when it looked really bleak, was a testament to how good my team was. But also as well, it made me realize that actually a Paralympic medal could be on the cards and I could be the first. So it actually like gave me even more motivation to try and pull it off in that three year period. And between maybe the end of 2012 all the way to 2016 was my best period, like in terms of peak, because of my Crohn's was under control and I was lucky enough that training was consistent enough for me to produce them numbers.
What sort of numbers are we talking about at this period, and what sort of body weight?
Yeah, so I said that I lost 20 kilo in body weight. So I managed to get to a body weight of, well, healthy body weight of about 55, 56 kilo, which is about 8.5 stone. And I lifted in the gym, 202 kilo. I managed to get 200 kilo about 8 times in my career. And I think my competition personal best is 195. So yeah, I managed to hit, well, nearly 4 times body weight. That was something that I never thought a human being could ever get to, especially in our sport anyway.
Mm. I mean, I'd be happy with that as a back squat, to be honest with you.
Well, yeah. It's better than my squat. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, phenomenal sort of appearances. And then we start to see that, you know, now, you know, you talk about the world record starting to collect some medals. Now, you know, as you say, the justification of the time and energy. And I'm imagining a few points along the way in that 4 or 5 year period where you thought, I'm going to pack it in, or were you always committed to the challenge, or what did that look like?
I think no matter how bad it got, I never lost sight of why I was doing it. We always said that we had to accept from the beginning of the process that it was going to be a difficult one, and one where medical science just hasn't caught up. Back then, there was no available evidence to suggest what we were doing was right. Now, you can say that, you know, I used myself as a guinea pig. I guess I did. But what we did do was we managed to prove that you can still get human levels of elite performance with a chronic illness, regardless if it's Crohn's or anything else. It can be done with the right team that are going to be all in with you, and also the right mindset as an athlete to absorb exactly what's going to come to you. We had to be very adaptable mentally because, trust me, it was more bad days than good days, and thinking, you know, how on earth are we going to get to that end point without, you know, we call it like, you know, can we get to a point where that I'm still safe enough to carry on? Like, we'll never ever try cross that bridge of it's now too dangerous. We never allowed us to get to that point because all the monitoring strategies which suggest that, okay, we're still safe enough to do it, and would never allow ourselves to go over that point. So it was trying to keep under that point at all times and still carry on even when, you know, it didn't look too good.
So looking back over your career, we've got gold medals, silver medals, bronze medals. You know, we're traveling all around the world, Glasgow, the Gold Coast, Dubai, Rio, Beijing. Looking back, what was the peak?
Oh, the peak. Well, you can't get, for me, 2015, 2016 were my peak years where I benched 200 consistently. And I guess I broke the world record twice at the Glasgow Commonwealth Games. But I think for me, I think on paper, that Paralympic medal, the one that we really wanted growing up, the one that, you know, people said it couldn't be done, what was obviously going to be the highlight. Now, the irony is, I wasn't the first Crohn sufferer to pull it off because, as you know, the Paralympic Games comes after the Olympics. And 2 weeks before at the Olympics, a swimmer from America who's got Crohn's won a silver. She beat me to it. But you know what? Having two Crohn sufferers in the space of 2 weeks to do that is, you know, it was incredible for the community. But the irony was, I wasn't the first, I was the second because of timing.
By 2 weeks as well. Not a full Olympic cycle.
By 2 weeks.
But I'm guessing the silver medal helped to calm me down a bit.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because that medal completed the career slam for me. It meant that I had the full set.
Mm-hmm. So looking back over your career, you know, there's so many things you could pull out in terms of, you know, takeaways, the challenge overcoming Crohn's, you know, being the first person to get a medal, you know, just setting world records. What are your biggest takeaways looking back over your career as an athlete?
I think the biggest one for me, and I know this sounds a bit cliche, but the advice that I always had was, if you have one eye on the outcome, then you've only got one eye on the process. A process that is challenging, unpredictable, chaotic. So actually the outcome becomes a distraction. So you have to have two eyes on the process at all times. And if you accumulate enough consistent days, you're going to give yourself a good shot at whatever the outcome is. So I always, you know, if you're looking back, it's forget about the outcome, like what placing you want or what medal you want. Put in the work on a daily basis because, you know, you just don't know what the process will come up with, and make sure that you hang in there like with your team and just do the right things. Because a lot of people, I'm not saying they live in delusion land or they're, you know, dreaming, but sometimes they think of the outcome without even like going through a process. They don't understand what you have to go through. So I always say like, yeah, focus on what you can control on a daily basis, accumulate enough consistent days, and you're going to give yourself a good shot at that outcome.
It's amazing advice and a great takeaway that's applicable to all walks of life, isn't it? Whether it's academia, sport, career, etc. So definitely something to take away. It's one of my big bugbears about SMART goals, I think. People get really caught up in SMART goals, which is exactly what you're talking about. It's the outcome. But then, you know, you can walk away from this and go, right, what does that look like tomorrow? You know, it's actually, as you say, it's in the process. You know, I don't know who said it, but something like along the lines of, you know, the outcome isn't guaranteed, but the work is. And I think people get caught up in the outcome and they don't focus on the work.
But think like, even if you don't reach that outcome, you can look back and go, actually, I gave it absolutely everything in that process. And I've actually learned a lot about myself, the abilities that I developed, so I can carry it on to any other area that I want. And maybe the outcome maybe was a little bit too big, but actually I'm glad I aimed for that such a big, you know, goal. Because I always say to people, like, aim for the impossible. And if you get very close to it, you've done something very, very good. And we did. We aimed for the impossible and actually did it, which is crazy.
So, Ellie, you must be a bit of a sadist, because not content with a full haul of international medals, you're undertaking your PhD as well. So tell us a bit about that. What is the life look like after sport, and what are you looking at in your PhD?
Yeah, for my sins. So as I mentioned previously, like, powerlifting historically has the most, like, anti-doping rule violations across the para sports. I guess in weightlifting, it's the same for the Olympics. Now, all my career, I don't know if that sounds a bit geeky, but I've studied the system in terms of anti-doping. And I felt like there was this gaps in terms of what can be done to protect clean athletes. But a lot of the research, well, the majority focuses on the Olympic athletes and able-bodied athletes, and actually neglects any para research. So my PhD is basically anti-doping and cheating methods in para sport, trying to hopefully come up with recommendations so that the system has a more, well, one, has data, but two, can become informed in how they proceed in terms of future policies.
So what does that look like? Obviously, anytime you get into the world of doping, people aren't going to stick their hand up and walk forward and say, oh yeah, I'd love to chat about my history of doping. And as an insider in the sport, you will also have seen people that you like. That's, you knowing what I know, that person is, it's like the classic thing, isn't it? When Lance Armstrong was beating everyone and everyone else was getting caught for doping, you're like, okay, come on. You're either an alien or you just have better drugs than other people. So yeah. What does that look like in terms of your methodology? How are you collecting this information?
Yeah, so as you said, not many athletes are willing to tell the truth. But it's weird, because as an athlete, other athletes from other nations tell you exactly what they're doing. The thing is, it's your word against theirs. You can't prove it. It's just their word. They could be joking. They could be, could be banter. I don't know. But because I'm one of them, they'll happily speak to me about what they're doing. And also, we as athletes, we're not silly. Like, we know the signs of what doping is. Like, we can see the physical, like, traits and when somebody's done it. Unfortunately, the system's not like that. There's no common sense there. You have to, violate a few violations for you to, for you to get banned, and not necessarily look at the effects of doping itself. But when you're trying to research it, you have to make sure that the research is completely anonymous. You can't track it back to any athlete. So we're using methods that the World Anti-Doping Agency are using now, where they've come up with a prevalence model that potentially could be used to protect the identities of athletes that, that want to do the studies, and to make sure that we understand what is the prevalence rate in terms of doping, especially in para sport. So that's the method that I'm using. Hopefully that, reassures athletes that I'm not going to be able to find out if they've done it or not.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting area, isn't it? Because as you say, once you're inside, people talk, and because as you said, unless you get a positive test, it's your word against theirs. Do you think athletes opened up to you because they thought you were doing similar, and so they were like, what are you using, how do we, and you were, but we were surprised when you said, actually, I'm not.
Yeah, so there's a story once. I was at an international competition, another team came up to me, or like at lunch, I think, and he said to me, what doctors do you use to get better? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, what doctors do you use to get better? So I thought he was talking about my Crohn's. So I started talking to him about my Crohn's, and he's like, no. He goes, what doctors do you use to get better at performance? And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, oh no, just the drugs that I use is food. I was taking the, taking the mickey out of him. And he goes, oh, we're on a supplement program. And I was like, oh my, you just literally admitted, because he thought I was on it, because, to him, I was really good. So you thought, I must be on it. There's a perception where, I guess because of the lack of education in other countries, there's a perception that everyone's doing it. And obviously that's not the case, but when you have that perception, you're more likely to do it.
Yeah, 100%, isn't it? Because I think if you have that perception, and you know, I've read a number of, you know, read the book Speed Trap, I've read Dwayne Chambers' autobiography, and you know, those things around the perception of, well, I'm 10th in the top 10 and the other nine are doing it, so if I want to get on the podium, I've got to do what everyone else is doing, does help justify that mentally, doesn't it? To go, well, I'm at a disadvantage now, so if they're doing that, I need to get on a level field with them. But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, that's why, you know, we're lucky in this country to have a great funding system that gives us sports science to bridge that gap. But I guess other countries are not as fortunate, so they use other means to win.
So you're one of these people who are annoyingly, you know, your fingers in a lot of pies in terms of amazing athletic career, undertaking your PhD. Another aspect is your passion and enthusiasm for making physical activity and sport more accessible to the disabled population. So tell us a bit around the startup and the app that you've been involved in developing.
Yeah, so during the first lockdown in 2020, had a little bit more time on my hands, like everybody did. And I started kind of reflecting on my Paralympic career, because I kind of knew that Tokyo could potentially be my last one. And I started questioning myself in terms of, was I good enough? Did I bench press what I wanted? How would I be remembered as someone that's, you know, half decent or, you know, great? But looking back, it wasn't the medals or the records or what I bench pressed that got to me. It was actually the fact that I never questioned why I was the only disabled person in the gym growing up. I never questioned it. Like, I thought maybe I was just more determined. Was I more adaptable? Because the facilities that I used as a kid, they were terrible facilities. I just adapted, right? I just got on with it. I thought to myself, why did you never ask that question? And two, has that changed 18 years? If you fast forward 18 years, has that changed? And the answer is that we still don't see disabled people going to gyms and integrating, especially when it comes to exercise. And I started thinking about, right, what are the barriers here? Like, what am I missing? Like, as a Paralympic athlete, I'm privileged as a disabled person. I probably don't even know the community in terms of, you know, experiencing what they have, but I need to understand. So I thought, well, the fitness industry is vast. There's so many fitness apps out there that are available. Like, everyone can get fit, and they can get fit in a number of different ways. Surely there must be a fitness app for disabled people. So I thought, I'm going to do some research, because I was intrigued. I wanted to see what the app would look like. So did some research. About 2 hours in, I was like, wait a minute, there's 70,000 fitness apps on the market globally, and none catered especially for disabled people. And the disability offering were generic and also like a sideshow of the main app. So they were hidden. And I was like, this is a joke. Like, we're in the 21st century, like, tech is advanced to levels that we've never seen before, and we can't get a population to be active. So as a disabled person, so I took myself away from like my elite sporting brain and thought, as a disabled person, if there was a fitness app out there, what could it look like? How could I bring access to exercise that allows the user to be in control of their journeys without relying on able-bodied people to give them advice? So I started writing things down. Within half an hour, I had an idea on paper, but there were three problems. One, I'm not a tech person at all. I can't code. I'm not an IT engineer. I'm just an elite athlete. Two, I'm not an entrepreneur. That's not my forte. I compete for my country. That's about it. And three, I'm not a multi-millionaire. So, it's a tech startup. So that's going to be a lot of money. So I thought about giving it away to somebody else that had that experience, and, you know, they could do what they want with it, but the idea is there. But then I called up my manager and a close friend who I've known for like 12 years. And I said to him, like, can you make me accountable to what I've just said to you? Like, I pitched to him. And he said, well, it's a crazy idea, but it has to be you that does it. Because, like, what you just said to me and the features and how it's going to work, able-bodied people don't think like that. Like, you've got experience, you've got lived experience. He said, you've got to do it. Like, it has to be you. And I was like, oh, God, this is going to kill me. Like, I'm actually a busy man. I don't need a startup on top. So within a year of the idea being on paper, we managed to launch it in July 2021. So it's live in the UK. And it's, I think from my knowledge, it's the world's first complete fitness app, especially designed for the disability community.
And what does it look like for the end user? Because, you know, we use the label or the category of disability, but there's a lot going on under that label, isn't there?
Yeah, so the fitness industry is quite generic, right? It gives you training programs which are not personalized. And the way I thought was I had to forget about the structure of the fitness industry and the way it does things and actually completely throw out the window, because with disability, you can't be generic because there's so many impairments. So what an amputee can do, a person with spinal cord injuries can't do. So you can't be, you can't generalize a program. Two, different disabilities have different complexities. So you have to be very impairment specific. And three, I thought to myself, I can't offer training programs to all these impairments because I'm not an expert on their impairment. And there isn't 180 world leading experts that have that knowledge. So I thought to myself, no, the user has to be in charge, but how can we make them in charge? So for us, the big feature in the app is we offer a catalog of video exercises demonstrated by somebody with your impairment. So they're just a demo of the exercise. So what the user does, it allows them to see how an exercise is adapted to their impairment because they've got that demonstration. They get to learn about different exercises for different body parts. And if they like any of the videos, all they have to do is basically put the videos together of what they want to do. And that creates a training session for them. And they get to be in charge of their journeys. They get to track it. So they get to put in the reps and sets they've done, and they get to track it over time. What that does is it guides them, it educates them, but also it puts them in control without relying on anybody else. On their journeys, which gives them full control, and that's what I wanted. It wasn't actually that hard to put it on paper because that was the first thing I thought about. But I thought to myself, why are people saying it's such an incredible idea? I thought it was just common sense.
Yeah, I guess you know the complexity of having so many different challenges, whether it's cerebral palsy, individual or someone with, as you said, a spinal cord injury. So many different variables and moving parts there. And as someone who has dabbled in making videos just from use in my own business, it must have been hours and hours and hours of recording videos and editing them and uploading. What did that process of building look like for the end user gets to see the app, but the blood, sweat and tears that went into it, what was that like?
Yeah, painful. I said from the start, this app has to be evidence-based. It could not be plucking exercises out of sky. And I thought, right, how can it be evidence-based? Because, I've only got a sports science degree. I'm not a strength conditioning coach, even though I went through the process 12 years ago. I thought, okay, I don't want it to be a medical app, because I think we need to get away from disability being a medical problem. We have to, kind of give them the tools in order for them to live independently in that space. So I thought, right, okay, who's the most evidence-based organization in the country when it comes to, exercise, but also that I've got experience working with elite para athletes, UKCA. If I use their coaches to potentially regress all the work they do in the 1% of para athletes, but regress up to down in a way where it kind of gives access to the general community, that for now I feel was evidence-based enough for us to actually write the content and script the exercises. Also, to give me another buffer to keep me accountable, we managed to sign a research partnership with Loughborough University to make sure that everything going into the app in terms of functionality, exercises, usage was accessible. So it kept me accountable publicly, but also in academic journals when they get published. So I had to basically I tried my best to make sure that as a startup, we were doing things right from the beginning.
Amazing, mate. Really, really phenomenal. In every aspect, from the athlete career to the PhD, this stuff, like, your contribution is colossal, right? From wanting to be the first Crohn's medal winner, to, you know, wanting to look at anti-doping sport, to wanting to make stuff more accessible. It's clear that, you know, legacy and mission and impact is a big factor for you. So where can people find out more about what you're doing? So if there's someone listening here who has a disabled family member, or someone, you know, a colleague who's disabled, or who, you know, is struggling with these things, where can people find out more about the app and about what you're doing in the space?
Yeah, so if you follow Accessorize on social media, you'll get to learn what we're doing, but also you can contact me as well if you want any more information. At the moment, we've got three impairments in the app, and we're growing the impairment offering every couple of months. As you can imagine, for us to do the research, do the exercises, film it, it takes about 3 to 6 months, depending on the impairment. So for example, cerebral palsy is coming next year, but cerebral palsy has a spectrum. So you have to sub-categorize it, and that takes a lot of work. So we're asking people, because their impairment is not in the app yet, just to be patient with us, because we're only a team of two.
Yeah, it's a big mission for a team of two.
Yeah.
Well, Ali, it's been absolutely fantastic speaking with you this morning, mate, just to hear about your journey as a Paralympic athlete, the challenges overcoming Crohn's, you know, the commitment to stick with the process and see it through, and you know, the outcome that you rightly achieved. So thanks so much for sharing your story this morning. It's been fantastic, and I know it'll be not only inspirational, but hopefully, you know, applicable for a lot of people listening, and also hopefully helpful beyond that for the population that you're trying to cater to.
No, thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love your support by leaving a rating or review on your chosen podcast player. You can also find us on social media using @LTAD Network. Thanks for listening to this episode. And don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform, as well as 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50.